bodies are not close together. And you already know that nothing can separate you from Calvin when you kive together. Yes, she was with Calvin. They were together. She felt the warmth of his quick smile, a smile which always had a slight quirk of sadness and acceptance unusual in a 16-year-old. He was not kiving in words now, but in great waves of courage, of strength, flowing over and through her. She accepted it, absorbed it. Fortitude. She was going to need a great deal. She opened herself, drank it in. All right, Proganoscus told them. We are together. We can continue. What are we to do? Mr. Jenkins asked. The second test, the cherubim urged. We must pass the second test. And that is? To name Sporos, as Meg had to name you. But Sporos is already named. Not until he has deepened. I don't understand. When Sporos deepens, Proganoscus told Mr. Jenkins, it means that he comes of age. It means that he grows up. The temptation for Ferandula or for man or for star is to stay an immature pleasure seeker. When we seek our own pleasure as the ultimate good, we place ourselves as the center of the universe. A pharaoh or a man or a star has his place in the universe, but nothing created is the center. Meg asked, the little Ferandali who saved me? They came of age, Meg. She pondered this. I think I understand. I don't, Mr. Jenkins said. I thought we came here to try to help Charles Wallace, that he is ill because of his mitochondria. Proganoscus pushed back impatience. He is. But what does Sparrows have to do with Charles Wallace? The balance of life within Yada is precarious. If Sporos and the others of his generation do not deepen, the balance will be altered. If the Ferandali refuse to deepen, the song will be stilled and Charles Wallace will die. The Ekthroi will have won. But a child, Mr. Jenkins asked. One small child. Why is he so important? It is the pattern throughout creation. One child, one man, can swing the balance of the universe. In your own Earth history, what would have happened if Charlemagne had fallen at Roncesvalles? One minor skirmish. It would have been an Ekthroi victory? And your history would have been even darker than it is. Mr. Jenkins, Meg called. Listen, I just remembered. For want of a nail, the shoe was lost. For want of a shoe, the horse was lost. For want of a horse, the rider was lost. For want of a rider, the message was lost. For want of the message, the battle was lost. For want of the battle, the war was lost. For want of the war, the kingdom was lost. And all for the want of a horseshoe nail. We must save Charles Wallace, Mr. Jenkins cried. What can we do, Progo? What can we do? Chapter 11. Sporos. A burst of harmony so brilliant that it almost overwhelmed them surrounded Meg, the cherubim, Calvin, and Mr. Jenkins. But after a moment of breathlessness, Meg was able to open herself to the song of the Pharai, these strange creatures who were deepened, rooted, yet never separated from each other, no matter how great the distance. We are the song of the universe. We sing with the angelic host. We are the musicians. The Pharai and the stars are the singers. Our song orders the rhythm of creation. Calvin asked, how can you sing with the stars? There was surprise at the question. It is the song. We sing it together. That is our joy and our being. But how do you know about stars in here, inside? How could Pharai not know about stars when Pharai and stars sing together? You can't see the stars. How can you possibly know about them? Total incomprehension from the Pharai. If Meg and Calvin kived in visual images, this was their limitation. The Pharai had moved beyond physical sight. Okay, Calvin said. I know how little of ourselves and of our brains we've learned to use. We have billions of brain cells, and we use only the tiniest portion of them. Mr. Jenkins added with his dry, ropey kive, I have heard that the number of cells in the brain and the number of stars in the universe is said to be exactly equal. Progo, Meg asked, you memorize the names of all the stars. How many are there? How many? Great heavens, Earthling, I haven't the faintest idea. But you said your last assignment was to memorize the names of all of them. I did. All the stars in all the galaxies, and that's a great many. But how many? What difference does it make? I know their names. I don't know how many there are. It's their names that matter. The strong writhing of the pharae joined Progonoscus. And the song. If it were not for the support of the singing of the galaxies, we pharae on Yada would have lost the melody. So few of the Ferandali are deepening. The unnamers are at work. Meg felt a sudden chill, a pulling back, a fading of the deepened pharae. There was dissonance in the harmony. The rhythm faltered. In her mind's eye, an image was flashed of a troop of Ferandali dancing wildly about one pharae tree, going faster and faster until she felt dizzy.
Sporos is with them, Progonoscus told her.
What are they doing? Why are they spinning faster and faster? The circle of Ferandali revolved so rapidly that it became a swirling blur. The fronds of the great pharae around whom they swirled began to droop.
They are absorbing the nourishment which the pharae needs. The pharae is Senex, from whom Sporos came.
There was chill in Progonoscus's words. The speed of the dancing Ferandali became like a scream in Meg's ears. Stop! She cried. Stop it at once! There was nothing merry or joyful in the dance. It was savage, wild, furious. Then, through the raging of the dance came a strong, pure strain of melody, quiet, certain, noble. The dancing Ferandali broke their circle and scampered about aimlessly. Then, led by Sporos, they raced to another pharae and began circling it. The fronds of Senex greened, lifted.
Progonoscus said, he is strong enough to hold out longer than any of the other pharae, but even Senex cannot hold out forever.
He stopped abruptly. Feel. Feel? The rhythm of the mitochondrion. Is it my fearfulness, or is Yada faltering?
It is not you, Meg answered the cherubim.
They were all very still, listening, feeling. Again there came a slight irregularity in the steady pulsing, a faltering, a missed beat. Then it steadied, continued. Like a gash through the non-light of Yada, Meg had a brief vision of Charles Wallace lying in his small room, gasping for air. She thought she saw Dr. Louise, but the strange thing was that she could not tell whether it was Dr. Louise Calubra or Louise the actual Calubra.
Don't give up. Breathe, Charles, breathe.
And a steady voice, it's time to try oxygen. Then she was drawn back within the mitochondrion to Senex, the parent tree of Sporos. She tried to convey to him what she had just seen, but she received nothing from him in return. His incomprehension was even greater than Mr. Jenkins's had been. She asked Progonoscus, does Senex know that Charles Wallace even exists?
As you know that your galaxy, the Milky Way, exists.
Does he know that Charles Wallace is ill?
As you know that your Earth is ill, by fish dying in the rivers, birds dying in the forests, people dying in the choked cities. You know by war and hate and chaos.
Senex knows his mitochondrion is ill because the Ferandali will not deepen and many pharae are dying.
Listen. Kive.
A group of Ferandali whirled about a pharae. Fronds drooped. Color drained. The dance was a scream of laughter, ugly laughter. Meg smelled the stench, which was like the stench in the twins' garden when she had first encountered an ekthros. She heard a voice. It was like a bad tape recording of Mr. Jenkins.
You need not deepen and lose your power to move, to dance. No one can force you to. Do not listen to the pharae. Listen to me.
The great central trunk of the surrounded pharae began to weaken. Meg tried to project herself into the dance to break the vortex. Sporos, come out. Don't listen. You were sent to the teacher. You belong with us. Come out, Sporos. You are meant to deepen. Then it was as though she were the end skater in a violent game of crack the whip.
and suddenly was flung so wildly across the ice that she crashed into the end of the rink. The force with which she had been thrown was so fierce that her kiving was completely blacked out.
"Breathe, Meg, breathe." It was Proganoscus, using the same words which Louise was using with Charles Wallace. "Breathe, Meg. You're all right."
She reeled, staggered, regained her balance. Again she heard the ugly laugh and the false Mr. Jenkins' voice urging, "Kill the Pharah!" Then she heard Mr. Jenkins' own voice. "I see. I understand." She felt emanating from him a dry, dusty acknowledgement of unpleasant fact. She returned sharply, still slightly breathless. "I don't understand." Mr. Jenkins asked her, "Why did Hitler want to control the world? Or Napoleon? Or Tiberius?" "I don't know. I don't know why anyone would. I think it would be awful."
"But you admit that they did, Margaret."
"They wanted to," she conceded, "but they didn't succeed." "They did a remarkably good job of succeeding for a period of time, and they will not lightly be forgotten. A great many people perished during the years of their rules."
"But Ferandelli, why would little Ferandelli like Sporos?"
"They appear to be not that unlike human beings."
She felt cold and quiet. Once Mr. Jenkins had accepted the situation, he understood it better than she did. She asked,
"Okay, then, what have the Ekthroi got to do with it? They're behind it, aren't they?"
Proganoscus answered, "The Ekthroi are always behind war."
Meg turned in anguish towards Senex, calm and strong as an oak tree, but unlike the oak, pliable, able to bend with wind and weather.
"Senex, we've been sent to help, but I'm not strong enough to fight the Ekthroi. I can't stop Sporos and the other Ferandelli from killing the Pharah."
"Oh, Senex, if they succeed, won't they kill themselves too?"
Senex responded coldly, quietly, "Yes."
"This is insane," Mr. Jenkins said.
Proganoscus answered, "All war is insane."
"But as I understand it," Mr. Jenkins continued, "we are a minutely immeasurable part of Charles Wallace."
"We are."
"Therefore, if, while we are on, or rather in, this mitochondrion, if Charles Wallace were to die, then, we
die too."
"Then I fight not only for Charles Wallace's life, but for Meg's, and Calvin's, and
your own."
Meg felt Mr. Jenkins's total indifference to his own life. She was not yet willing to accept the burden of his concern for her.
"We mustn't think about that. We mustn't think about anything but Charles."
Proganoscus wound around and through her thoughts.
"You cannot show your concern for Charles Wallace now accepting concern for Sporos. Don't you understand that we're all part of one another, and the Ekthroi are trying to splinter us in just the same way that they're trying to destroy all creation?"
The dancing Ferandelli whirled and screamed, and Meg thought she could hear Sporos's voice.
"We're not part of anybody. We're Ferandelli, and we're going to take over Yada after that."
A hideous screech of laughter assailed Meg's ears. Again, she flung herself at the dance, trying to pull Sporos out of it. Senex drew her back with the power of his kive.
"Not that way, not by force."
"But Sporos has to deepen. He has to."
Then, around the edges of her awareness, Meg heard a twinkling, and Calvin was with Sporos, trying to reach out to him, to kithe with him. Sporos's response was jangly, but he came out of the wild circle and hovered on its periphery.
"Why did Blajini send you alien lifeforms to Yada with me? How can you possibly help with my schooling? We make music by ourselves. We don't need you."
Meg felt Proganoscus's volcanic upheaving, felt a violent wind, searing tongues of flame.
"Idiot, idiot,"
Proganoscus was sending. "We all need each other. Every atom in the universe is dependent on every other."
"I don't need you."
Suddenly Proganoscus kithed quietly and simply.
"I need you, Sporos. We all of us need you. Charles Wallace needs you."
"I don't need Charles Wallace."
Calvin kithed urgently.
"Don't you? What happens to you if something happens to Charles Wallace?"
Who have you been listening to? Sporus withdrew. Meg could not feel him at all. Calvin emanated frustration. I can't reach him. He slips away from me every time I think I'm getting close. Sporus was pulled back into the whirling circle. The surrounded Pharah was limp, all life draining rapidly. Senex mourned. His song is going out. Proganoscus writhed, exed, snuffed out like a candle. Senex's fronds drooped in grief. Sporos and his generation listened to those who would silence the singing. They listened to those who would put out the light of the song. Mr. Jenkins raised shadowy arms prophetically. To kill the song is the only salvation. No, Mr. Jenkins cried to Mr. Jenkins. You are only a mirror vision of me. You are nothing. 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 The word echoed, hollow, empty, repeating endlessly. Everywhere Meg writhed, she seemed to meet a projection of an ekthros, Mr. Jenkins. Don't you understand that the Ekthroi are your saviors? When everything is nothing, there will be no more war, no illness, no death. There will be no more poverty, no more pain, no more slums, no more starvation. Senex writhed through the Ekthros. No more singing. Proganoscus joined Senex. No more stars or cherubim or the light of the moon on the sea. And Calvin. There will never be another meal around table. No one will ever break bread or drink wine with his companions. Meg writhed violently against the nearest Ekthros, Mr. Jenkins. You are nothing. You're only borrowing, Mr. Jenkins, in order to be something. Go away. You are nothing. Then she was aware that the real Mr. Jenkins was trying to reach her. Nature abhors a vacuum. Calvin replied. Then we must fill the vacuum. That is the only thing to do. How? If the Ekthroi are nothingness, emptiness, then that emptiness can be filled. Yes, but how do we fill it? Senex writhed calmly. Perhaps you don't want to fill it strongly enough. Perhaps you do not yet understand what is at stake. I do. A little boy, my brother. What do you know about my little brother? Senex conveyed considerable confusion. He had a feeling for the word brother, because all Pharai are, or had been, brothers, but little boy meant nothing to him whatsoever. I know that my galactic host is ill, perhaps dying. That's Charles Wallace. That's my little brother. He may be a galactic host to you, but to me he's just a little boy like Sporos. She turned her kithe from Senex and towards the wildly dancing Ferandali who had surrounded another Pharah. This time she kithed herself towards them cautiously. How could she be sure which one was Sporos? An Ekthros, Mr. Jenkins, whinnied with laughter. It doesn't matter. Nothing matters. A harsh twang wounded the melody of the Pharai who were still singing. Once again, Meg felt faltering in the mitochondrion. Yada was in pain. Suddenly she remembered the Ferandali who had saved her from the Ekthros when Proganoscus brought her into Yada. Not all the Ferandali had thrown in their lot with the Ekthroi. Or were those who had exed themselves that she might live the only ones who would defy the Ekthroi? She began calling urgently, Sporos! Ferandali! Come away from the Ekthroi. You will dance yourselves to death. Come to Senex and deepen. This is what you were born to do. Come. Some of the Ferandali faltered. Others whirled the faster, crying, We don't need to deepen. That's only an old superstition. It's a stupid song they sing, all this glory, glory, glory. We are the ones who are glorious. The stars, Meg called desperately. Another superstition. There are no stars. We are the greatest beings in the universe. Ugliness seeped past Meg and to Sporos. Why do you want to deepen? Sporos's twinkling was slightly dissonant. Ferandali are born to deepen. Fool, once you deepen and put down roots, you won't be able to romp around as you do now. But
You'll be stuck in one place forever with those fuddy-duddy Pharaoh, and you won't be able to run or move ever again. But the strength and calm of Senex cut through the ugliness. It is only when we are fully rooted that we are really able to move. Indecision quivered throughout Sporos. Senex continued, It is true, small offspring. Now that I am rooted, I am no longer limited by motion. Now I may move anywhere in the universe. I sing with the stars. I dance with the galaxies. I share in the joy and in the grief. We Pharaoh must have our part in the rhythm of the mitochondria, or we cannot be. If we cannot be, then we are not. You mean you die? Meg asked. Is that what you call it? Perhaps, I am not sure. But the song of Yada is no longer full and rich. It is flaccid, its harmonies meager. By our arrogance we make Yada suffer. Meg felt Calvin beside Senex urging, Sporos, you are my partner, we are to work together. Why? You're no use to me. Sporos, we are partners, whether we like it or not. Meg joined in, Sporos, we need you to help save Charles Wallace. Why do we have to bother about this Charles Wallace? He's nothing but a stupid human child. He's your galaxy. That ought to make him special enough, even for you. A cruel slashing cut between their writhing as though a great beak had cut a jagged wound. Sporos, it is I, Mr. Jenkins. I am the teacher who is greater than all teachers because I know the Ekthroi. Meg felt Progonoscus's writhing clamp like steel. The Ekthros Mr. Jenkins was holding Sporos and speaking with honey-sweet words. Do not listen to the Earthlings. Do not listen to the Pharaoh. They are stupid and weak. Listen to me and you will be powerful like the Ekthroi. You will rule the universe. Sporos! The real Mr. Jenkins's writhing was not strong enough to break through the stream. He is not Mr. Jenkins. Do not listen. Calvin's writhe came more strongly than Mr. Jenkins's. There are two Mr. Jenkinses by you, Sporos. Two Mr. Jenkinses writhing you. You know that one is not real. Deepen, Sporos. That is where your reality lies. That is how you will find your place and how you will find your true center. Meg's mind's ears were assailed by a howling which was Ekthroid, though it appeared to come from the pseudo-Mr. Jenkins. Reality is meaningless. Nothing is the center. Come, join the others in the race. Only a few more Pharaoh to surround, and you will have Yada for your own. Yada will die, Meg cried. We will all die. You will die. If you come with us, you will be nothing, the Ekthros Mr. Jenkins spoke in cloying kithe, and nothing can happen to nothing. Sporus's long whiskers trembled painfully. I am very young. I should not be asked to make major decisions for several centuries. You're old enough to listen to Senex, Meg told him. You're old enough to listen to me. After all, I'm a galaxy to you. It's time for you to deepen. Sporos wriggled in the clasp of the Ekthros, Mr. Jenkins. Come, Sporos, fly with the Ekthroi. Then you will crackle across the universe. There are too many mitochondria in creation. There are too many stars in the heavens. Come with us to naught. To naught. Deepen, Sporos, my child, deepen. Sporos, the Ekthroid howl beat against the rhythm of Yada. We will make you a prince among Ekthroi. Meg felt a gust of wind, the familiar flicker of flame. Progonoscus, the cherubim, flung his kithing across the void of the Ekthros, Mr. Jenkins, like a rope flung from cliff's edge to cliff's edge.
Sporos, all Ferandali are royal. All singers of the song are princes.
Nonsense, in name only.
The name matters.
Only to matter.
Proganoscus's kithing was so gentle that it undercut the storm of Ekthroi. You are created matter, Sporos. You are part of the great plan, an indispensable part. You are needed, Sporos. You have your own unique share in the freedom of creation.
Do not listen to that hideous cherubim. He's nothing but a deformed emanation of energy. We will give you no name and you will have power.
Calvin pushed in again. Sporos, you are my partner. Whatever we do, we must do it together. If you join the wild Ferandali again, I'm coming into the dance with you. Sporos quivered. To help kill the Pharai? No. To be with you. Meg cried, Progo, let's go too. We can help Calvin. In her impetuous relief at having something to do, she did not feel the cherubim pulling her back, but plunged into the irrational tarantella and was immediately swept out of control. Calvin was whirling beside Sporos, unable to pull him away from the circle closing in on the dying Phara. Meg was totally in the power of the revolving, twangling Ferandali. The orbital velocity sucked her in, through the circle, and against the limp trunk of the Phara. Within the deathly center of the dance, it was dark. She could not image the whirling Ferandali. She could not kithe Calvin or Sporos. She heard only a silence which was not silence, because within this vortex there was an emptiness which precluded the possibility of sound. Caught in this anguished vacuum, she was utterly powerless. She was sucked against the trunk of the Phara, but the Phara was now too weak to hold her up. It was she who had to hold the dying deepened one, to give it her own life's blood. She felt it being drained from her. The Phara's trunk strengthened. It was Meg who was dying. Then arms were around her, holding her, pouring life back into her. Mr. Jenkins's arms, the real Mr. Jenkins, his strength and love filled her. As she returned to life, the firm, rhythmic tendrils of the reviving Phara caressed her. Mr. Jenkins held them both, and his power did not weaken. The murderous circle was broken. Calvin held Sporos in his arms, and a tear slid down his cheek. Meg turned towards him to comfort him. The moment she kithed away from Mr. Jenkins and to Calvin, a new circle formed, not of Ferandali, but of Mr. Jenkins's swirling their deathly ring around the real Mr. Jenkins. Meg whirled back towards him, but it was too late. Mr. Jenkins was surrounded. Meg cried, Deepen, Sporos! It's the only hope! The scattered Ferandali darted hither and thither in confusion. Proganoscus reached out wing after invisible wing to pull them in. There was a frightened twingle.
Look at the Ekthroi, Proganoscus commanded. They are killing Mr. Jenkins as they made you kill your own Pharai. Look, this is what it is like.
Mr. Jenkins, Meg called. We have to save Mr. Jenkins. Oh, Sporos, deepen. It's the second ordeal. You must deepen.
For Mr. Jenkins?
For yourself. For all of us.
But why did Mr. Jenkins? Didn't he know what would happen to him?
Of course he knew. He did it to save us.
To save us all, Calvin added.
The Ekthroi have him, Sporos. They are going to kill him. What are you going to do?
Sporos turned toward Senex, the Phara from whom he had been born. He reached out small green tendrils towards all the Ferandali.
It is deepening time, he said.
They heard a faint echo of the music which had been such joy when Blajini took them to witness the birth of a star.
The Pharai were singing. Singing. Strengthening.
Sporos was joining in the song. All about them Ferandali were deepening and adding their music to the flowing of the song. Meg's exhaustion and relief were so great that she forgot Mr. Jenkins.
She assumed blindly that now that Sporos and the other Ferandali were deepening, now that the second ordeal had been successfully accomplished, all was well. The Akthroi were vanquished. Charles Wallace would recover. She could relax. Then she felt Proganoscus pushing through her thoughtlessness. Meg, you forget. There are three tests. She turned from rejoicing. The circle of pseudo-Mr. Jenkinses was whirling wildly about the principal, closing in on him. Proganoscus writhed so strongly that she was pulled back into painful awareness. We cannot let the Akthroi get Mr. Jenkins. This is the third test to rescue Mr. Jenkins. Senex, Sporos, everybody, help us! Meg heard a shrill, high scream, a scream that turned into a horrible laugh of triumph. It came from Mr. Jenkins. One Mr. Jenkins. There was no longer a spiral of Akthroi Jenkinses surrounding the principal. They had closed in and entered their prey. Proganoscus's writhing cut like a knife. The Akthroi have him. We must get him away. Chapter 12. A Wind in the Door. The Akthroi's Mr. Jenkins reached towards them. The horrible familiar stench assailed Meg. A loathsome writhing came to her in Mr. Jenkins's tone, superimposed on the whine of metal rubbing against metal.
Nonsense! Of course the Akthroi haven't got me. I am Mr. Jenkins, and I took the Akthroi into me because they are right. It is not the Akthroi who are empty. It was I. They have filled me with the pleasure of the abyss of nothingness. Come, let me ex you. Come to me, come.
Sporos's long, tenderly whiskers quivered. A faint twinkling came from them, but now he was writhing, his young greenery moving rhythmically, his delicate new needles and leaves and blades shimmering with the rhythm of Senex, of the singing pharae, of Yada. Earthlings, forgive me. I will sing for you. The Akthroi cannot bear the song. Mr. Jenkins writhed like a corkscrew.
Life as we have known it is meaningless, Margaret. Civilization has failed. Your parents know this. They are giving up.
No, no, Calvin protested. They're not like that. They'd never give up.
Sing, Sporos called to the deepening Ferandali. Sing with us. Our galaxy is in danger. We must save him.
Mr. Jenkins overrode him.
There is no hope except extinguishment. Let us hasten it.
Meg cried through the boring of the corkscrew. Mr. Jenkins, no! Stop it! Calvin joined her. Mr. Jenkins, come back. Come out of the Akthroi.
I am back. I am here. I am finally myself. Nothing. X, Mr. Jenkins. To be X'd is the only good.
Again, Meg felt a bone-shattering wrench. Every muscle in her cried out in protest. Then she was flashed a brilliant image of Calvin tugging at Mr. Jenkins. Powerful images of Calvin wrestling with a Mr. Jenkins suddenly wild and strong. Mr. Jenkins's thin, flabby arms beat at Calvin with steel spring blows. Calvin, with his lithe wiriness, eluded most of the blows and tried desperately to catch Mr. Jenkins by the wrists, caught him. The wrists became talons, became nothing. Calvin was left holding nothing. Meg heard the screeching Akthroi laugh, and Mr. Jenkins hit Calvin a thundering blow. Meg saw red blackness, Calvin reeling, being pulled, sucked into the vortex of the Akthroi's Mr. Jenkins. Then the images of Calvin staggering from the blow, steadying himself, readying himself, vanished. The images were gone. But Calvin was there, was with her, was part of her. She had moved beyond knowing him in sensory images to that place which is beyond images. Now she was writhing Calvin, not red hair or freckles or eager blue eyes or the glowing smile, nor was she hearing the deep voice with the occasional treble cracking. Not any of this, but Calvin. She was with Calvin. Writhing with every atom of her being, returning to him all the fortitude and endurance and hope which he had given her. Then she felt Proganoscus trying to get her attention and turned her writhe unwillingly towards him. Meg, I can help Calvin, but I can't help Mr. Jenkins. You may be able to. Try to go to him. Perhaps you can still reach him. She pulled back. If she went to the Ekthroid, Mr. Jenkins, would the pain of the Ekthroid take her again? There were no little Ferandali to save her this time. She could not do it, could not knowingly open herself to that pain. But Mr. Jenkins had come into the whirling circle of death for her sake. If Mr. Jenkins was possessed by Ekthroi now, it was because of his love for her. She gave a sigh of acceptance of what she must do. Then she turned her scythe towards Mr. Jenkins, who was somewhere in the horrible Ekthroid version of himself. "Mr. Jenkins!" She flung her scythe towards him with all her might. And now she no longer saw the thinning brown hair, the same mouse brown as her own, or the middle-aged eyes behind the lenses of the horn-rimmed spectacles, or the sloping shoulders with the light snowfall of dandruff, but something deeper, more real, beyond, past, through the senses, something which was the true person. She was with Mr. Jenkins as she had been with Calvin. Calvin, who was so important to her that she didn't dare even whisper to herself how important he was. Mr. Jenkins, too, was real, and she was with him, scything herself entirely to him. From somewhere deep inside the Ekthroid version of himself, he was trying to say something. He was repeating, repeating, and finally she heard a phrase he had used earlier. Nature abhors a vacuum. The single phrase was all he could manage. She held on to it. If the Ekthroi are nothing and Mr. Jenkins is now part of that nothing, if Calvin is being exed into that nothing, fill it! Fill it! Came Calvin's desperate scythe. Through it came a vivid image of Charles Wallace, blue and gasping, her parents standing by his bed. Dr. Louise working the emergency oxygen tank, Fortinbras lying across the threshold as though to bar death from entering the room. Fill it! She was cold with desperation. Progo! Progo! What do I do? She heard only an echo of Calvin's call. Fill the vacuum! Fill it! He was fighting desperately, not for his own life, but for Meg's, for Charles Wallace's, for the singing Farai, for the whole of being. She scythed wildly. Progo, we passed the first test. I named Mr. Jenkins. And the second, Sporos has deepened. Are we failing the third test? Calvin can't hold out any longer. Do I have to go into the Ekthroi? Is that what I have to do? What will you do if I fail? She knew. She knew what Progonoscus would do. Calvin was weakening rapidly, unable to counter the sledgehammer blows of the Ekthros Mr. Jenkins. She flung herself into Mr. Jenkins, trying to hold the cruel arms, trying to pull him away from Calvin by the sheer force of her scythe. The pain, it came again as she had known it would. Agony. Red anguish pounding against her eyeballs. Charles Wallace was sharing in that anguish, his parents helpless as his small body convulsed in spasms of pain. They struggled to hold him, the Murrays, the Louises, to hold him during the convulsions, to give the racked frame support. Fortinbras stood in the doorway growling, his hackles rising. The Ekthroi were... Meg's scythe was faint, almost obliterated by pain. Calvin, Mr. Jenkins... Don't fight the Ekthroi. Help me fill them. Cold. Cold beyond snow and ice and falling mercury. Cold beyond the absolute zero of outer space. Cold pulverizing her into nothingness. Cold and pain. She struggled. You are not to ex me, Ekthroi. I fill you. Cold. Darkness. Emptiness. Nothing. Naught. Naught. Ekth. X. Then, Progonoscus. A great cry, a tempest of wind, a lightning flash of fire across the cold, breaking, burning the cold and pain. Progonoscus Xing. Wings. All the wings, stretched to their fullest span, eyes, all the eyes opening and closing, opening, dimming. Oh, no. Going out. No. Flame.
smoke, feathers flying, Progonoscus flinging his great cherubic self into the void of the Ekthroi who were exing Mr. Jenkins and Calvin and Meg and Charles Wallace. Wings and flame and wind, a great howling of all the hurricanes in the world meeting and battling. Progo! Her cry writhed across Yada, and then she knew what she must do. She must do as Mr. Jenkins had done when he had broken through the mad circle of whirling ferandali and held her. She must hold the Ekthroi, hold them by holding Mr. Jenkins and Calvin, by holding Charles Wallace. Hold them, Meg. Hold them all. Put your arms around them, around the Ekthroi, spreading their gaping, tearing nothingness across creation. Size does not matter. You can hold them all. Charles and Calvin and Mr. Jenkins and the burning sphere of the newborn star. She cried out, I hold you. I love you. I name you. I name you Ekthroi. You are not nothing. You are. A small white feather, which was not a feather, floated through the cold. I name you Ekthroi. I name you Meg. I name you Calvin. I name you Mr. Jenkins. I name you Progonoscus. I fill you with naming. Be. Be butterfly and behemoth. Be galaxy and grasshopper. Star and sparrow. You matter. You are. Be. Be caterpillar and comet. Be porcupine and planet. Sea sand and solar system. Sing with us. Dance with us. Rejoice with us. For the glory of creation, seagulls and seraphim, angel worms and angel host, chrysanthemum and cherubim, oh, cherubim, be. Sing for the glory of the living and the loving, the flaming of creation. Sing with us. Dance with us. Be with us. Be. They were not her words only. They were the words of Senex, of the deepening Sporos, of all the singing Pharae, the laughter of the greening Ferandali, Yada itself, all the mitochondria, all the human hosts, the earth, the sun, the dance of the star whose birthing she had seen, the galaxies, the cherubim and seraphim, wind and fire, the words of the glory. Ekthroi, you are named. My arms surround you. You are no longer nothing. You are. You are filled. You are me. You are. Meg. Meg! Her encircling arms were around Charles Wallace. Where? Where doesn't matter. Here. Here in Charles Wallace's familiar room. Meg. Calvin. Mr. Jenkins. One Mr. Jenkins. The real Mr. Jenkins. The Murrays. Dr. Louise, her stethoscope swinging loosely about her neck, looking disheveled, exhausted, happy. The twins. Dennis, with a big smudge of garden earth across his face, both boys still grubby and tired from their labors. And Charles Wallace. Charles Wallace sitting up in bed, breathing quite easily and normally. Fortinbras no longer guarded the door, which now stood invitingly open. The oxygen tank no longer needed was in the corner.
Charles! Oh, Charles Wallace!
Meg hugged him, swallowing a large and unexpected sob.
Are you all right? Are you really all right?
He's much better, Dr. Louise said. We know very little about mitochondritis, but... Her delicate little bird's voice faded off, and she looked questioningly at Meg. So did her father.
Whatever happened, wherever you were, Charles Wallace was talking about mitochondria and ferandali in his delirium, and something which sounded like Ekthroi.
And about you, her mother added. Meg explained flatly. We were in one of Charles Wallace's mitochondria. Mr. Murray pushed his spectacles up his nose in the same gesture which his daughter used. So he said. He looked at his youngest son. I am not in a doubting mood. Mrs. Murray said,
just when we thought... when we thought it was all over. Charles Wallace gasped. The Ekthroi are gone. And suddenly his breathing started to improve.
All I can say, Dennis said, is that when Charles Wallace goes back to school, he'd better not talk the way he was doing while he was delirious.
I don't understand any of this, Sandy said. I don't like things I don't understand.
If Mother and Father hadn't been so upset about Charles Wallace, Dennis glared at Meg, they'd have been furious with you for not coming right home from school.
Where were you anyhow? Sandy asked.
Do you really expect us to swallow this stuff about your being inside Charles Wallace?
If you'd just be realistic for once.
After all, we were worried too. And then some.
They looked at Meg, then wheeled and looked at Mr. Jenkins. Mr. Jenkins said, Meg is quite correct. And I was with her.
The twins replied with total and stunned silence. Finally, Dennis shrugged and said, Maybe one day someone will get around to telling us what really went on.
I suppose since Charles is all right, we'll just be glad about that. All's well that ends well and all that stuff, even if everybody's holding out on us as usual.
They turned to Dr. Louise.
Charles is really okay? Is Charles really all right?
Dr. Louise answered them. It's my opinion that he'll be completely recovered in a day or so.
Meg confronted Mr. Jenkins.
Okay, but what about school? Won't the trouble there go on just as miserably as ever?
Mr. Jenkins sounded his most acid.
I think not.
What will you do, Mr. Jenkins? Can you make things different?
I don't know. I cannot dictate Charles Wallace's safety. He must learn himself to adapt. But I have less fear of the situation than I did before. After our, recent experiences, the old red schoolhouse is going to be easier to enter each morning. Now I think that I am going to find upgrading an elementary school a pleasant change.
And at the moment it seems a quite possible challenge. The twins again looked astonished. Sandy asked in a deflated way,
Well, then, isn't anybody hungry?
We were so worried about Charles, we haven't eaten for...
I'd like a turkey dinner, Charles Wallace said.
Mrs. Murray looked at him, and some of the strain eased from her face.
I'm afraid I can't manage that, but I can thaw some steaks from the freezer.
Can I come down when dinner is ready?
Dr. Louise looked at him with her sharply probing gaze.
I don't see why not. Meg, you and Calvin stay with him until then. The rest of us will go to the kitchen to be useful. Come along, Mr. Jenkins, you can help me set the table.
When the three of them were alone, Charles Wallace said to Calvin,
You didn't say a word.
I didn't need to. Calvin sat on the foot of Charles Wallace's bed. He looked as tired as Dr. Louise and as happy. He put one hand lightly over Meg's. It will be good to have a feast together and celebrate.
Meg cried,
How can we have a feast without Progo?
I haven't forgotten Progo, Meg.
But where is he?
Meg, he exed himself.
But where is he?
Where doesn't matter.
Calvin's hand pressed more strongly against Meg's. As Progo might say, he is named, and so he's all right.
The Ekthroi did not get Progo, Meg. He exed of his own volition.
But Calvin, Progonoscus is a cherubim, Meg. It was his own choice.
Meg's eyes were too bright.
I wish human beings couldn't have feelings. I am having feelings.
They hurt.
Charles Wallace hugged her.
I didn't imagine my dragons, did I?
As he had intended her to, she gave a watery smile. Immediately after dinner, Dr. Louise ordered Charles Wallace back to bed. Meg held out her arms to kiss him goodnight. She knew that he was aware of her feeling of incompleteness without Progonoscus, and as he kissed her cheek, he whispered,
Why don't you and Calvin go out to the north pasture and the big rocks and look around?
She nodded, then glanced at Calvin. Wordlessly, they slipped out to the pantry and put on ski jackets. When they had left the house behind them, he said,
"It's funny to talk instead of kithing, isn't it?
I suppose we'd better get used to it." She walked close beside him, across the rich, newly spaded earth of the garden.
"There are things we aren't going to be able to talk about in front of people except in kithing."
Calvin reached for one of her mittened hands.
"I have a feeling we're not supposed to talk about them too much."
Meg asked, "But Blajini, where's Blajini?" Calvin's hand held hers firmly.
"I don't know, Meg. I suspect that he's wherever he's been sent, teaching."
They paused at the stone wall.
"It's a cold night, Meg. I don't think Louise will come out."
He climbed the wall and moved swiftly to the two glacial rocks. The great stones loomed darkly against the sky. The grass about them was crunchy with frost and empty.
Meg said, "Let's go to the star-watching rock."
The star-watching rock lay coldly under the brilliance of the stars. There was nothing there. A tear trickled down Meg's cheek, and she wiped it away with the back of one mitten. Calvin put his arm around her.
"I know, Meg. I want to know what's happened to Progo, too. All I know is that somehow or other, he's all right."
"I think I know he's all right, but my mind would like to be in on the knowing," she shivered.
"We'd better go in. I promised your parents we wouldn't stay out long."
She felt an extraordinary reluctance to leave, but she allowed Calvin to lead her away. When they reached the stone wall, she stopped.
"Wait a minute.
Louise isn't—" Calvin started, but a dark shadow slid out of the stones, uncoiled slowly and gracefully, and bowed to them.
"Oh, Louise," Meg said. "Louise."
But Louise had dropped to the wall again and disappeared somewhere within it. Nevertheless, Meg felt comforted and reassured. In silence, they returned to the house. In the pantry, they hung their jackets on the hooks. The door to the lab was closed. So was the door to the kitchen. Then the kitchen door blew open with a bang. Sandy and Dennis were at the dining table doing homework.
"Hey," Sandy said. "You don't need to be so violent. You could just open the door. You don't have to take it off its hinges."
"We didn't touch the door," Meg said. "It blew open." Sandy slammed his Latin text shut.
"That's nonsense. There's hardly any wind tonight, and what there is coming from the opposite direction."
Dennis looked up from his math paper.
"Charles Wallace wants you to come upstairs to him, Meg."
"Shut the door at any rate. It's cold." Sandy got up and shut the door firmly.
"You were gone long enough. Did you count the stars or something?"
"We don't have to count them," Meg said. "They just need to be known by name." Calvin's eyes met hers for a long moment and held her gaze, not speaking, not kithing, simply being. Then she went up to Charles Wallace.
This is Jennifer Ely. We hope you've enjoyed this unabridged production of A Wind in the Door by Madeline L'Engle. This program was directed by Kevin Thompson. Producer, Orly Moskowitz. Text copyright, 1973 by Crosswicks Limited. Production copyright, 2012, Random House, Inc. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.